This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nagel. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network today and on our Wildlife Wednesday. And we're taking a vacation, sort of, to Florida. Scott Graven is back, and he's the one on vacation. And he has lots of info about what is going on in that state when it comes to wildlife. And then we're going to talk about Wisconsin animals on how they're dealing with the lack of snow this winter and chronic wasting disease. But why don't you join the conversation? When you visit Florida, what animals do you look for? Share your wildlife observations with us by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Scott, good to talk to you.
Well, great to talk to the folks back home. This is it's a wonderful situation all the way around.
For you.
Well, I'll just tell you about it, make me feel a little better. It's chilly down here by Florida standards. The folks have been, oh my God, this is awful. And it's, you know, 50 degrees and people are pretty bundled up, but I find it quite pleasant, actually.
Sounds perfect to me. Is it sunny? That's what I want to know.
There's an occasional shower and whatnot, but for the most part, it's living up to its name as
okay.
The Sunshine State, and it's quite nice, and the beaches are quite nice and uncrowded because it's a little chilly, so
sure.
it's all good.
Yeah,
it's
well, good for you. What are you doing down there, Scott, besides enjoying the weather?
Well, enjoying the weather, but basically, you know, again, just escaping a little bit of the snow season. I'm also doing a little scouting around because of COVID and some other issues. The Everglades tours that I was helping lead with the folks from Door County Nature Travel that we often talk about on public radio, and then get populated by public radio listeners. We've only been down here once in the last 4 years, and we're planning hopefully a trip down again next winter, and we'll mention when that's available and people can sign up if they're interested. But we spend a lot of time in the Everglades and other spots along Southwest Florida birding and shelling and doing the typical Florida activities and enjoying the weather. So I'm scouting out some of our locations first and foremost, to see if they're still here.
Yeah.
Because Hurricane Ian rearranged the landscape, and that's one of the things I find interesting is looking at the horrific damage, of course, to human properties, buildings and whatnot, but also to the environment. Case in point, I was standing on the beach this morning talking to a fellow surf fishing, trying to pick up some tips, and he just happened to mention, he said, well, you know, there used to be a big sandbar here, and this was a good spot for this or that reason. But he said it was all completely rearranged by Hurricane Ian. The sandbar was gone. The beach was rearranged. And of course there was still evident damage to the vegetation and properties along the beach. So it takes a while for the area to recover from a storm of that magnitude.
Now I heard Sanibel was really, really hit. Have you been in that location at all?
Yes, and Pine Island as well, which mm-hmm. is another popular destination. My wife and I were down here last winter as well, just, you know, 6 or 8 weeks after Ian went through, and it was horrific. I have great sympathy for the folks who went through it, but the vegetation will grow back, and whereas last year flying in there were, it seemed like every fourth or fifth roof was covered with blue tarp because the roofs were ripped off or damaged. All those tarps have disappeared now, as far as we can see, and things are coming back pretty quickly. So it's pleasant to be down here, and I really felt coming down. We drove.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like a robin on migration. I know how they feel now. Every place we stopped and chatted with anybody, they were from the upper Midwest or the Canadian provinces or whatnot, and they were all headed to the same place. It was just a huge caravan of thousands of vehicles all headed down here somewhere to the coast to escape some winter weather.
Sure, so, yeah. Well, when you're down there, I'm sure you're going to be looking and talking and about some of the wildlife species down there. I mean, manatees are obviously the first ones that you think about. How are they doing down there? I know they're at risk, but what's their status right now?
Well, they're still a threatened species, and there's been great concern over the last few winters that they've had increased mortality events. 3 years ago, I think they experienced or found or documented over 1,100 manatees dead. And 2 years ago, that diminished to, I think, about 800. And this year to date, in the same reporting period, they're down to about 500. So the mortalities are diminishing. The emergency feeding program that was instated, I forget, I've got the figures here somewhere, but I think it's like something like 400,000 pounds of lettuce that they had distributed to various sites where manatees congregate to feed them. Because one of the big problems beyond the cold and other things was that the seagrass that they depend on as their primary food source had been tremendously degraded in some areas like the Indian River estuary due to various forms of runoff and pollution from the incredible growth that Florida is still experiencing. So they've made great strides in stemming some of those problems. The seagrass seems to be coming back. Manatee mortality is down, and generally the outlook is pretty good. It's the population is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 8,000 to 11,000, something like that. So when 1,000 were dying a year, and it's an animal that can live to be 65, then that's a source of concern. But and there's still concern, and there's still a protected species, but things are looking a little better.
Well, that's definitely good news. And then also there's sea turtles, and I think there were some problems with them being cold stunned. Is that a thing?
Yeah, what they call the syndrome is the turtles are stunned by the cold, sometimes right here on the Gulf and the Atlantic coast. But in this case, these were turtles further northeast, even up to New England, that were suffering from cold stun. And essentially, it's so cold that they just shut down. They can't eat. They don't swim. They just float on the surface, basically inert, and eventually wash up on beaches, and people pick them up. As there was a big outbreak in Texas a couple of years ago when they had some brutal winter storms, and hundreds of sea turtles are collected, and they're basically brought inside, put in swimming pools and such, and warmed up, basically, thawed out, rehabilitated, and then released into the wild. And this time around, Florida comes into it because there were large numbers of turtles shipped down here to various turtle rehab centers. There's one over near Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach. There's one at the Moat Marine Center and just north of where I am in Sarasota, and other ones where these turtles were coming from the north, being warmed up and rehabilitated, and then essentially released. So it's unfortunate that the cold spells hit them like that, but the good news is they're successful. It's not too difficult to rehabilitate them and get them back into the environment.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the opposite end of temperatures, Florida had some record warm temperatures this summer. Have there been any long-term effects at this point?
Not that I've heard much about. Okay. You know, the temperature, I think the place that seems to be warming right now is actually on the home front in Wisconsin on your own. On your own news broadcast, there was just an account for how virtually no ice on the Great Lakes this year. First time that's ever happened. But I guess the last thing as far as the Florida scene that I'll put in the good news category is that there's finally been an agreement between the various water management districts, the Corps of Engineers and others, that something has to be done to restore the freshwater flow into the Everglades. And after about 100 years of neglect and ditching and damming and diking and draining and so forth, they're actually going to create a large water management district south of Lake Okeechobee, which will essentially be a large reservoir and wetland complex to store water, filter it, clean it up, and then let it take its natural course of flow into the Everglades as opposed to diverting it. And I think the number was something, it was an astronomical figure of 75 or 100 billion gallons of water a year that will, clean water, that will be clean, fresh water that will be allowed to replenish and nourish the Everglades and make what the what the accounts are saying will be a significant difference in allowing the Everglades to restore itself. So since that's one of the spots we've spent some time in on our tour, everybody's happy to hear about that. So it'll take years, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's been a long time coming, so it's great that they've turned that around. Now, you're talking about beaches a little bit ago, and they're great places for shelling, especially on the Gulf side, and fishing, of course. So what are some of your tips for people who do these activities, but they want to do it responsibly? What should they be aware of?
Well, let's talk about shelling a little bit first. That's kind of a hit or miss proposition depending on storms and tides and winds and so forth. There are certainly lots of shells out there, and it's a very popular activity. I've been out the last few days. I really enjoy shelling. I kind of view it as treasure hunting, and you know, I know the shells well enough to know what the rare and unusual ones are, and that's what you keep your eye out for. But I find them all fascinating and beautiful works of nature. How an animal is simply, it kind of looks like, think about an oyster, for example. It's just a blob of gelatinous material that some people really enjoy. But these creatures are fairly simple and nondescript, and yet they create these beautiful, lasting works of art, in a sense, that people enjoy picking up on the beach. And usually a storm front that brings high surf brings shells in from the bottom, deposits them on the beach. And for a few days after a storm, the shelling can be terrific. There are other days when it seems, wow, there's hardly a shell here. So the people who are here long enough or learn a little bit about that, learn how the weather impacts that, and can do well. Yesterday, for example, I think I probably had the best day I've ever had on the beach as far as shells. The shells on the Boca Grande beaches were 2 feet thick in places, as the waves washed over them and sorted them out, you could just essentially pick up what you wanted.
Wow.
Now, in terms of the ethics and responsibility that you mentioned, a part of that is making absolutely sure that anything you pick up is not a live shell. Those, in other words, the animal's still home. Those have to be returned to the water immediately. So you have to pay a little attention to that. And even if it's not the original occupant, could be a hermit crab that's taken occupancy of said shell, and same thing, put them back in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of responsibility, as well as the idea of, take what you can use for your craft projects or to gift or whatever you want to do, but you don't need to necessarily pick up every shell, because there are lines of people combing the beach up and down who would like to find some of these things as well. So that's about the extent of it, but it's a low impact, just a fun thing to do, walking along the beach on a nice day, looking for these natural treasures.
Mm-hmm. And wear your sunscreen, Scott.
I haven't had to worry about that too much, because I've had a sweatshirt and hat on.
That's true.
It'll be fine. It's supposed to be near 80 here in the next few days.
Handle that. Yeah,
that'll be really nice.
This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. And we'll be back in just a second, and we'll talk to Scott about some wildlife things closer to home. Give us a call if you have any questions. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, ideas@wpr.org. And we're talking with an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, Scott Craven, today. He's down in Florida. And Scott, before we go back to Wisconsin wildlife, Matt and Madison emailed us just to the observation that the Everglades are a prime example of putting short-term profit ahead of all else. And the Everglades have been drained and manipulated to grow crops and provide housing for retirees. Not to mention, the Everglades are almost completely devoid of mammals of any kind. Burmese pythons have eaten the lot, altering the historical water flow for decades, had a devastating effect on the glades and changed them forever. What comments do you have about that one?
Well, that's a very insightful comment, and I appreciate it, and it's all true. The only thing I would add is that although there was tremendous degradation and there has been lots of construction and so forth, there are still a lot of natural areas in Florida, and the bulk of the Everglades is now protected by a variety of things, a series of state lands, the glades itself in terms of the national park, and Big Cypress Swamp, and a variety of other designations that from Miami on the east over to the Naples area on the west have led to the vast majority of that landscape being protected in perpetuity. So what's left to be protected is protected. And if some of these water projects remediate some of the damage that was done in terms of blocking water flow, as I said, the future looks pretty good. From the standpoint of the observation about mammals virtually disappearing, that certainly is true. And the efforts to try and control pythons, as well as a variety of other invasive species in the Everglades, is ongoing and probably in the long run is a tougher nut to crack, so to speak, than the water control. I think people know what to do about that if they just have the resources and the political support to do it. Mm-hmm. Trying to do something about invasive species, whether it's iguanas or pythons or primates or whatever else, is much more challenging. And dealing with the pythons is a handful. The last time we were down with our tour group, the folks in the Everglades were telling us that raccoons, for example, virtually gone. And the comment a couple of the local guides made was that 95% of the mammals previously present in the glades gone.
Oh, that's sad. What about fish, Scott? Do they eat fish too, or is it just the mammals?
Well, they don't, but on the fish scene, it's a little different problem. For example, when we visit the boardwalk at Big Cypress that kind of goes out over some mangrove waterways and so forth, you look down into the clear water and say, holy cow, look at all those fish. And say, wait a minute, that looks like something I had in my aquarium.
Oh.
And in fact, what you're usually looking at is huge numbers of cichlids and oscars and some catfish that you see in aquarium stores, things that have gotten a foothold in the glades because, again, they were dumped in there by people who thought, well, I don't want this aquarium anymore. What'll I do? Well, let's give the fish a new home.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's the way most of this stuff got here.
Mm-hmm.
And the aquatic environment for those invasive fish, non-native fish, is just as beneficial, I guess, as the warm, grassy, moist habitat that the pythons have enjoyed, and so they proliferate, and the impacts are incredible and incredibly difficult to deal with. So anyway, the college observations were all spot on.
Okay. Now, if it's not that many or like basically no mammals for them to eat, will that cause the population of pythons then to decrease?
Well, you'd like to think so, but mm-hmm. they're spreading. So that's one problem. When food's in short supply, they can suffer on site. But most species, when food's in short supply, tend to wander looking for food. And so pythons are extending their range and also turning to other food sources, birds, reptiles like small alligators and so on. So there'll continue to be effects for some time. People are making a Herculean effort to try and get them out of there, but the Everglades is a big place. It's very dense, inhospitable landscape to just wander through, and therefore it's not easy to find these snakes. Even if people wanted to. And, mm-hmm. and so far there's been nothing anyone's come up with by way of that might affect their reproduction, some sort of a sterilizing drug, or some creative or imaginative solution like that has not yet surfaced, but maybe it will.
Okay. Fingers crossed.
And maybe technology, whether it's drones that can somehow seek them out or some other advance, and technology that maybe makes it a little bit easier to control these things. That's about the best we can hope for.
Yeah, there's always something new. Well, let's get back here to Wisconsin now. We don't have a snake problem, but we've had kind of a snow problem. There hasn't been much this year. How is that affecting wildlife?
Well, it's a good news, bad news situation. It certainly affects the wildlife of our snowmobile enthusiasts and so forth, because that's been pretty well shut down. But on the one hand, it makes life a lot simpler. With moderate temperatures and no snow cover, the crop fields are still exposed. So whether it's geese that are still hanging around or deer that are foraging in the whatever waste grain is left, or songbirds, food is easier to come by. And with less snow comes less cold, and that makes it a little easier in terms of energy balance and so forth. So for some species, the general lack of snow and the more moderate temperatures is a blessing. So the winter severity index that the DNR maintains that is correlated with overwinter deer survival is probably still standing at zero in some places. So that's the plus side. On the negative side, there are some issues. If we get cold weather and without snow cover to insulate the ground, then frost goes deep, and that may be a problem for anything from hibernating amphibians to hibernating reptiles like box turtles and things like that. So there could be some impacts from deep penetrating frost. And there are a few animals that are keyed into using snow as a source of insulation. For example, in the North Woods, they get cold, really cold weather, or cold nights at least, and rough grouse that are that have evolved into roosting in deep powdery snow, using it for insulation, don't have that option, so they're having to deal with the cold and whatever impacts that might have. So the bottom line on the question, it's a mixed bag depending on who you are and where you are.
Sure. What about those few animals that actually turn white during the winter? Do they still turn white?
Yes, that's keyed more to day length and other normal changes that are not necessarily matter. Holy cow, there's snow on the ground. I better turn white.
Right.
They can't do that. So what you end up with is a white animal on a brown landscape. And, of course, for those that are like a snowshoe hare, for example, that stand out like a sore thumb, then all of a sudden that increases their vulnerability to predation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I went for a walk with my dog this morning, and I heard the birds singing like crazy. I had a thought, like, this is January, right? Very unusual. Strange. And speaking of sightings, WPR News just had a story this week about the American marten, and it's been, it's Wisconsin's only endangered mammal, and it was spotted on Madeline Island for the first time in 100 years. Can you tell us a little bit more about martens?
Well, they're a smallish member of the weasel family, a pretty little animal. As you say, they've been on the endangered species list for some time. And there have been efforts to restore them. And there are a couple of base populations up in our northern forests and also in the Apostle Islands where they've been hanging on and doing okay. They're certainly not abundant by any means. They're close relative to the fisher. The larger member of the weasel family was also restored 4, 5, 6 decades ago. Unlike the martens, the fishers have just exploded after they were reintroduced and became very abundant all across the North Woods and have even moved down into some of the southern or central or southern counties. So it depends a little bit on what you are, if you're an animal, whether you're a bit of a specialist or a generalist. And martens, in terms of their food habits and habitat needs and so forth, are a little more specific than fishers and haven't done quite as well. But the fact that they seem to be doing better on the Apostle Islands now and turning up on a number of the different islands, that's just good news that there's another stronghold for them. So they'll do fine.
great. We're talking to Scott Craven, wildlife expert. If you've got any questions, we've got open lines, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. And we were talking earlier about, you know, new tech for helping wildlife and the environment. And there have been some use of drones to recover deer. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's become a very popular thing in Wisconsin. You know, of course, deer hunting is a big deal economically, socially, ecologically, and so on. So, and on somewhat unfortunate sidelight is that every deer shot, whether it's with an arrow or a bullet or whatever, is not necessarily immediately recovered. They're a tough animal. And so wounded animals can travel significant distances and not be very easy to recover. But hunters are that's bothersome to hunters. Of course, they want to get the deer that they shot. They want to recover it. But it's also a strong ethic within the hunting community that you make every possible effort to recover wounded animals, not only to retrieve them for your use, but to put them out of any suffering that may be involved in that. So anyway, that's been a big deal for a long time, and folks in Wisconsin are creative and ingenious and come up with all sorts of solutions to problems. One of them was to train tracking dogs to recover wounded deer, and that's still a service that a number of people with dogs so trained offer as a service or a fee, depending on what they're doing. And then I think that normally evolved along with technology, like we were talking about, maybe providing some solutions in the Everglades to problems, to the use of drones that can get up above the tree canopy and with infrared technology as well as visual imaging with a camera during daylight hours, allow a vantage point that you know, no hunter or even dog can begin to approximate. So people began to explore the possibility of using infrared-capable drones to find the heat signature of a deer that was bedded down or moving through the woods or whatever, attempt to identify it as the one in question that someone was pursuing, and then essentially lead the hunter to that animal, be it still alive or dead, and make the recovery, and then everybody ends up happy. The hunter certainly is pleased to get their quarry without necessarily crashing through the underbrush with a group of friends for hours trying to find it. It can greatly facilitate the recovery of lost animals. That's a good thing all the way around. So anyway, that's proliferated. I just before I came down, I was reading that article in the paper, and I think there were something like 100 folks or more who were utilizing or offering the services of drone recovery, and I can only think that will proliferate as hunters realize, hey, this is really a labor-saving device. It greatly increases the chances that I'm going to find this deer, and that's a good thing from a humane standpoint and from a game of wildlife management standpoint. So I think it'll only get bigger.
Yes, I think so, too. We do have a call from Don in Bayfield County. Hi, Don. What's your question?
Hi. Good morning. Say, I'm wondering, with all the warm weather we had last month and all the rain we had, how is that affecting bears who are trying to hibernate?
As we mentioned, moderate weather with moderate temperatures and increased access to food supply and so forth is a good thing for all of these animals. But much like the animals we talked about that turn white, I mean, bears are programmed to spend the winter in hibernation. And that varies a little between the sex and age class of different bears. But while there might have been some small delay, I think the bears are tuned in to going down and getting to sleep, and it's just been a little easier for them to do that. But they still should go into hibernation. Whether they'll come out a little earlier or not in the spring remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that question, Don. We did get an email from Carl in Green Bay, and going back to Florida here, he's wondering, how do alligators and crocodiles coexist in Florida, and what are some safety tips for interacting with them? Don't, right?
don't interact. Well, you can't help but interact with them.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
In places where, you know, we see them around the area we're staying here, and they're kind of a curiosity, and they look like they could barely get out of their own way, but that's not the case. They can move pretty quickly if they need to or want to. But where they're habituated to people, for example, on this tour I've mentioned a couple of times, we visit a place called Shark Valley in the Everglades, where there's a long tram corridor that used to be part, I think, of oil development. Anyway, you take a long tram ride out and then get off at various places and wander around, and there's a trail up to an observation tower. If it's a warm, sunny day, that paved trail is usually covered with alligators, and some big ones. And you literally kind of step over them to continue on the trail. And that's a little nerve-wracking, but the alligators don't seem to care and seem completely oblivious to people's presence. But again, the rule of thumb, if you're not in an area like that where they're protected and seem to get along with people, the idea is don't mess with them. Don't try and grab one by the tail. Get a selfie. Don't try and sit on one. Give them some respect. They're big. They're powerful. They can be fast if they need to be, and their jaws are very, very strong and lots of teeth. Don't mess with them. Don't try and pick up little ones. Don't do anything. Just realize they're here, take a picture from a distance, and let them go on about their business. In terms of alligators versus crocodiles, there are a few American crocodiles way down in the southern tip of the Everglades, and they have their turf. The alligators occupy the entire rest of Florida, along the Gulf Coast and up into the Carolinas, over to Texas, and so on. So alligators are widely distributed and very abundant, and people know them and understand them. The crocodiles are very unusual, very restricted in their distribution, and the interaction is not a big factor.
Okay. Staying down in Florida here, Philip in Ashland is wondering by email where that you can go in Florida to see dolphins in the wild.
Dolphins?
Mm-hmm.
Just about anywhere along the coasts. In my experience roaming around, first of all, because dolphins are such a charismatic, popular creature, the tour operators, much the same as, you know, whale watching in some parts of the country, there are lots of tour operators in all the resort communities from the Gulf Coast down around Tampa and St. Petersburg and down to Naples and around through the Everglades and back up, that offer cruises to see these animals. And that's one of the easiest ways to do it. But I've always found that just sitting on the beach, whether it's watching a fishing rod or enjoying a cold beverage or just simply sitting, you'll see the dolphins cruising up and down the shoreline, sometimes one or two, sometimes a dozen or more. And just, you know, with a good pair of binoculars, although sometimes they're very close, you shouldn't have any trouble finding them to observe.
Mm-hmm. And Mary emailed us. She says that there are many, many wildlife sanctuaries in Florida. How can we tell as visitors if those sanctuaries are actually helping animals or if they're just using them for profits?
Well, I guess that's an interesting question, and it's a little difficult. I most of the time, the days of the old roadside zoo kind of attractions, kind of for lack of a better term, mom and pop operation where there's some animals in cages and you wondered about how they're being cared for and so forth, those things are largely gone. And the larger facilities, I think the one that comes to mind is Gatorland, a longtime Florida attraction. that, you know, people would see the billboards and let's go to Gatorland, and they've got all kinds of animals there, all kinds of gators and so forth on display. They seem to be well cared for, and I'm trying to remember the context, but I just saw an article or a news report within the last month or two that something had been taken, some gators, I don't remember the context, but the point was they had been taken to Gatorland for care and rehabilitation. So I think most of the facilities that have stood the test of time have realized that they need to embody a conservation ethic or a management ethic within their operation, that people have come to expect that and appreciate knowing that they're attempting to do some good in rehabilitating injured animals, restoring them to the wild, or making sure that as part of their breeding operation, that surplus animals are used to repopulate the environment or what have you. So that if it appears to be a commercial operation and they're profiting from this, well, that may be true, but the point is they're also protecting some habitat to operate their commercial operation, and that's probably, even if a couple species like a few alligators, I think of some of the airboat ride concessionaires down here in the Southwest that say, you know, see the gators, and you go out on the airboat and, yeah, this is the area frequented by Big Frank, our gator that's been in here. Watch out, Big, he's really dangerous. And they pull up next to a particular log. Oh, what a surprise. You know, there's Big Frank. And he's waiting for the chicken they're going to throw to him. Well, you know, okay, so there's a bit of an element of exploitation there. But on the other hand, the 40 or 80 or 500 acres that they're protecting to drive their airboats around is not only providing a home for Big Frank, but also all of his relatives and all kinds of aquatic or birds and other creatures that would not be doing so well if that had become yet another residential development. So that's the commercial side. But there are also a lot of facilities that become a tourist attraction. For example, the heating plants that have warm water discharge that are now heavily utilized by the manatees because the water's cool. So they set up a park or a viewing site and people get to come and see the manatees. For the facilities that are managed by the government, like the aforementioned Big Cypress and Everglades and so forth, obviously that's primarily directed at conservation. For the private groups, places like Corkscrew Swamp, the famous bird sanctuary just west of the Naples-Fort Myers area, run by the Audubon Society. Now, that's been there for years. It's a beautiful place, and it protects a huge chunk of wetland habitat with a boardwalk that people can walk along and see all sorts of birds, as well as alligators and snakes and so forth, that they might not have access to otherwise. So there's the private element, the public element, and the commercial element. But I think deep down, you'd have to look long and hard to find one that you could really criticize heavily as being just an exploitation of animals in any way at this point. I think we've gotten past that as a society.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you for the question, though. Our expert today is Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. What wildlife questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll talk with a Wisconsin architect about mid-century modern design and why it's so popular. And then we'll take a look at what's new with Habitat for Humanity. Right now, it's Wildlife Wednesday, and we're going to go straight to the phone. If you've got a question, the number 800-642-1234. And we got a call from Crawford County. Hi, Ross. What's your question?
Yeah, hi, Jill, and hi, Scott. So I'm, you know, living in southern Wisconsin, and I think of myself as being pro-wolf, And I think, well, the wolves are in northern Wisconsin. The DNR collects and has information about wolf predation and probably a lot more on top of that. And after all these years, I'm wondering, Scott, do you know, are farmers in northern Wisconsin and maybe just communities in general, are they changing their practice? Is there anything that they're learning that works with regard to, say, cattle predation on, wolf predation on cattle or on dogs?
I guess the gist of that are there techniques available that that reduce the opportunity for wolf predation on either livestock, particularly cattle, but also on the dog mortality that's taking place? Well, let's take the dogs first, because I think that's a little more straightforward. And the issue there is that dogs are presumably under the control of their owner, and if they're not, they should be. And if the owner is responsible about that, and certainly there are circumstances and times or instances where a dog is harmed or worse yet killed by wolves where the owner really had no idea there were wolves around or the circumstances. But in general, if you're out, as I am with my own Labradors, there are areas where the DNR has issued cautionary statements or warnings that, hey, there's an active wolf pack in this area, immediate area, or they have a history of interaction with the dogs or problems. Well, then I think common sense would say, hey, that's an area, at least in my case, I'm going to stay away from there. Similarly, due diligence in terms of when you let the dogs out to do their thing in the evening or whatever else, that you take some steps with the use of lights or noise or stay with the animal or whatever, if you think there's any real threat in the immediate area. So I guess responsible, conscientious dog ownership and management can go a long way. Can't solve all the problems, but would go a long way in terms of mitigating the problems. On the livestock side, sure, over time there's been work with herd management in terms of, you know, changing pastures, improving fencing, bringing them in at night, other kinds of husbandry practices that may help. But there have also, there's better understanding with the use of electric fences, use of what's called fladry or warning flags or other devices that may deter the wolves and things like that, that I think can help the problem, but again, not prevent it entirely. A hungry or desperate or injured wolf is going to overcome things that they might not otherwise to get an easy meal, and livestock can sometimes present an easy meal. If someone's interested in this, there's plenty of literature available now, and the USDA Wildlife Services people up in Rhinelander are up on all of this, on all this stuff and all the related material, and can certainly help a counselor, help a livestock producer do everything humanly possible to diminish the chance of wolf predation. But you can't diminish it to zero. So,
okay, thank you for that question, Ross. And we've got an email from Justin in Wapaka. He says he's a big fan of yours, Scott. He's got male cardinals calling in his neighborhood in Wapaka already, and that's several weeks early. And he thought that territorial calling was more tied to photo period. Perhaps there is a temperature control on territorial calling, too?
Well, there could be. It would certainly be. Usually hearing the male cardinals whistling in the treetops is something I look for in February, and I'm looking forward to hearing again this February after I leave Florida and return to the North Pole. It doesn't surprise me. You know, that's one of the attractions, I think, that people have for natural events is that they're, while they can be patterned, and if you study phenology, the occurrence of natural events and the way they're timed over the year, sure, there are patterns. And you expect that such and such a bird's going to return the first week of March, or such and such a bird's going to start singing or displaying at this particular period. But when you start to get abnormal weather, temperature, precipitation changes, and so forth, then it's a new ball game, so to speak. So it doesn't surprise me that some birds have stayed later than they would normally do in terms of migration, or that they may be starting up what we perceive as being springtime activities because, hey, it's pretty nice out there, folks. Let's get a jump on things. So it's not surprising, but it's for me it's a little disconcerting to think that some of these things are just more and more evidence of the impact of our changing climate, and in the long run, that's maybe a curiosity and of interest, but it's also problematic. So I don't know what to say. I don't think that the Cardinals are kicking off their breeding season yet, but the fact that a few may be getting in an early word or two, not terribly surprising.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. Marty in Kenosha has a question. Hi, Marty.
Hey. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I live on a lake, and it's a spring-fed lake, and one of the springs is right next door to me. Therefore, along my shoreline, it never freezes. We've had a couple of eagles now sitting in the big elm or oak tree above it, and last winter it dove down, picked up a fish, hopped up onto the ice, and, had breakfast. Is there any way that I can promote eagles to build a nest? And I'll listen to your response off air. Thank you.
The short answer is no, especially with it's a common question with raptors that, I wish I could keep this hawk around because it's helping control my rabbits, or I wish I could keep this eagle right here by this patch of open water because I enjoy seeing them. And the reality is if you either by good fortune have the habitat that these animals are looking for or can create it, and in some cases that might mean putting up a perch site that the hawks may hunt from, or that facilitating the eagles by making sure there's a good limb to perch on in that tree you mentioned, or clearing that out a little bit to make it easy for them, and do what you can along your shoreline to enhance their ability to see fish in the water or hunt there. There's not much more you can do if the habitat is. Now, I just qualify that for a moment. There are some things where you can do something very specific, like putting up a nest box for a barn owl or a nesting platform for ospreys. There are things you can do in those cases. But in terms of the eagles, no, they're going to be looking for a suitable nesting tree or site, and it may be a long way from your patch of open water, but they'll certainly come there to hunt and find food, especially if there's ice around other than that in little spring-fed area that you have. So you're lucky to be that close to a natural feature that's attractive to them, but there's probably not a great deal you can do to encourage them to nest in the area.
Mm-hmm. So enjoy them while you can. We had Rolf and Hayward emailed us, and they have a hound with an especially keen nose, and their simple solution to prevent issues with wolves, a leash. They don't let the dog out loose at night and they always walk her on a leash, so there's no problem unless the leash breaks, and then there are treats and secondary leash as a precaution.
Well, that's exactly the kind of conscientious, considerate pet management that I was talking to. So
right.
They've figured it out and is working for them. So, hey, keep up the good work.
Yeah. And one more, probably an easy question since we're almost news time. Robert emailed us and he says a developer in their neighborhood needs to remove a snag with a screech owl. Can it be removed? I'm assuming that's a legal question.
Yeah, well, it is, and you know, I'm not a conservation officer. My inclination is, since it's not what's really an issue here, it would be a nest, an active nest, a nest with eggs, a nest with young. Then there would be a problem. I think if it's just a matter of, hey, here's a hollow tree that the screech owl is using, maybe squirrels are using it, maybe a raccoon's using another hole. Well, it's unfortunate to have to take down a valuable den tree like that, but I don't think it's necessarily a legal issue. However, again, because I'm not a conservation officer, then I think it would be prudent on the developer's part to call their local warden, DNR warden, and say, hey, I need to move this tree. What's up? And the warden will either know off the top or contact somebody within the DNR who works with birds like that and can give them a straight legal answer.
And probably safer for everybody involved on that too, right?
I think it just avoids a potential conflict. Now, the fact that people in the area who may be familiar with that particular tree or view it as a valuable natural resource in the area, they may be a little upset about that, but I don't necessarily think that it can be stopped if it's in the way of some legal development.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, and thank you for listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're going to be back to take more of your questions right after we break for the news. And Gary and Deborah, hold on, please, and we'll get to you right when we get back. And you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about wildlife with our friend Scott Craven today. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And we're going to be talking about, a few things like CWD, which we haven't quite got to yet. But we do have a couple of callers on the line that have been waiting for a while. So we want to get to them right away. So Gary in the town of Ween, what's your question?
Good morning, Scott. Always great to hear your voice. I have two quick questions. One is, every evening I go out for a little walk around 11, 12 o'clock on my land, and I've been hearing two owls calling back and forth, and the first one will go hoo, 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 and then a pause, and then three more hoos, and then within a couple seconds, the second one, which would be to the northeast of the first, will go hoo, 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 a pause, and then two hoos. So I wonder if that's some kind of message.
It sounds like smoke signals in the old days in the West. It probably is just some individual. I think they're communicating with each other. You know, one's responding to the other one, just like if a turkey gobbles in the spring, usually another turkey will gobble, just to let them know that, hey, I'm over here and this is my spot, you stay where you are, kind of thing. And it's not unusual, even only here in January, in early January at that, for some of the great horned owls in Wisconsin to be cranked up and getting ready for the breeding season in February. So especially with the relatively modest weather we've been having, it's not surprising that they're calling. And it's, again, they're letting each other know where they are. But I don't think whether it's two who's or one who or three who's that we can really make much of that.
Well, they're probably just telling each other that Gary's out for a walk again.
Yeah, here comes Gary. Watch your step.
Gary.
What else have you got, Gary?
You had a question about something else.
What's the difference? How do you tell an albino deer from just a regular deer that's white?
Well, the leucistic deer is white, but has natural pigment, for example, in the eyes. The true albino is going to have pink eyes. So that's one of these. I mean, they may both be white, and then there's a piebald deer that's partially white, like a pinto horse, but they'll be normal in every other way. So it's primarily the fundamental characteristics of an albino, which is lack of pigment and pink eyes and so on, that would give it away. Not going to be an easy thing to determine in the wild, though, unless you're really close to it.
Yeah, I've got those binoculars out. Let's go to Deborah in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, yes. You were talking about drones and wolf predation, and I'm wondering if there are farmers using drones to protect their livestock from wolves or even dogs.
Well, that would be interesting.
That would be interesting. I'm not sure what the, you know, you can't keep a drone has a specific, you know, use window in terms of power source and so forth. So it's not like they could keep drones in the air 24/7 to see where the wolves were or where the wolves were juxtaposed with the cattle kind of thing. So I'm not sure about that application, except for the case where, boy, I know the wolves are getting close. I've got to find out where they are kind of thing and then maybe put a drone up. But that's not the main context we were discussing of drone use was for recovery of wounded or lost deer during the hunting season, and that was a thermal recognition thing. I'm not sure about the applications in the case of wolf livestock predation, but hey, it's hard to predict which way technology is going. Maybe artificial intelligence is going to come into play, and there'll be a way to watch over the livestock with something remotely. I simply don't know. Mm-hmm. I hope something comes along that helps, but I don't know what it would be.
And in that vein, we've got another call, Janet in West Madison. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks, Scott, for taking my call. I'm concerned about the population of the wolves. You talked about the protection from animals and livestock, but what about the protection from the wolves? And what's being done in Wisconsin to take care of some of that, especially since the wolf hunt was way overhunted in the last couple of years?
Well, that's the other side of the coin. Now, wolves need some management attention too, but currently, because they remain on the federal endangered species list, the agency, the DNR's hands are largely tied, and hunting cannot go back into effect until such time as they're removed from the federal list. There's lots of potential or pending legislation to do just that, but I'm not sure where it stands at this point and when it might happen. And it would probably be a judge's ruling that does it, and I suppose it could happen on the spur of the moment. The fly in the ointment there is that by Wisconsin law, as soon as, this is where we got into trouble the last time, as soon as the wolves are removed from the endangered species list, Wisconsin is obligated by law to implement a hunting season. And that's where the problem started the last time around, because it was done on the spur of the moment. But at least for right now, at this point in time, the wolves enjoy their protection of a federally protected endangered species. And other than problems with wolf control where there's documented depredations on livestock or a threat to human health and safety or problems on the highway, you know, roadkill and other things that befall wolves, not related to hunting, are all ongoing, but some of those are very difficult to contend with. So I think right now wolves are doing just fine in terms of their protected status, but that's the root cause of some of the problems with further or more detailed local management. So it's something of a moot point right now.
Okay, thank you, Janet. We've got David in Hales Corners. It's got some info for us. Go ahead, David.
Hi there. Thanks for your great show. And Scott Craven, it's good to hear your voice again. And the call about great horned owls, I sounded like the person was talking about noticing the difference in the calls of the great horned owls, males and females. Males having a deeper hoot and shorter call, female having a higher pitched hoot, even though she's bigger. So it could be the male, female. And I was, my understanding is they could be nesting right now, early in January rather than February, but being one of the earliest nesting birds.
Yes, they are. And yes, you're right. I mean, they could be. I'm completely out of ecological synchrony here, looking out the window at a palm tree and a swimming pool. So what's going on up there somewhat escapes me. But you're absolutely right. They could be getting underway right now. They may not have eggs right now, but the breeding activity and the calling and nesting preparation are certainly possibly underway. So you're absolutely right.
Yep. Thank you, David. Appreciate that observation. And before we go any further, let's talk about chronic wasting disease, ever-present in Wisconsin, and it seems to be spreading. How much does the public concern match the amount of scientific concern about CWD?
Wow, that's a good question, and I hope we have an hour and a half to cover it. there's a disconnect between the concern for the folks who work with the disease, understand the disease fully and its implications, and still, I think, generally view it as a tremendous threat to the deer herd, the deer hunting tradition in Wisconsin, and deer management, as opposed to the public, whoever they are, but the public, non-professionals, I guess, who in some cases are very knowledgeable about it and very concerned, and in other cases, yeah, whatever, I don't believe it, or it's a conspiracy theory or whatnot. So there's a tremendous spectrum from virtually no concern to great concern, and that's to me, that's a little troubling. I still see this came to a head a week or two before I left, when I talked with one of our outdoor writers who produced a column on the fact that, for example, corn is still widely sold and distributed as deer food and bait in areas where it's illegal to use it. And I got agitated about that because I saw a big display of corn in a store that I thought should know better, at least have a warning sign or something. But then he reminded me that, hey, it's no different than fireworks. You know, these tents full of fireworks spring up, and people readily buy them and use them, even though technically it's illegal to use anything that goes up or blows up. Mm-hmm. So that calmed me down a little bit. But nevertheless, you're absolutely right. It's still a disconnect that while it's a serious threat, and it does seem to be increasing in both distribution and intensity, concern for it has waned in the public. But, you know, with everything that's going on in the world and people's day-to-day lives in terms of, things like climate change or warfare around the world or whatever, is a disease that afflicts the deer herd of, that high on people's lists of keeping them up at night. And it probably isn't, and I get that. But for people who are concerned about the future of deer and deer hunting in Wisconsin, it has to remain on their minds. And if there are any breakthroughs or better ways to deal with it, they have to be embraced fully and quickly. But beyond that, it's out there, and it's going to be, I'm afraid, for a long time. So
other than, not feeding the deer, what else can we do to help with the efforts to slow the spread?
Well, not a great deal. There's no particular management program to turn to that, a cookbook plan, you do this, 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 and this, and then the following will happen. It's not that easy, and there is no immediate intervention. I mean, we saw what happened when it was first discovered, 20 plus years ago now, and there was a thought of, well, if we eradicate the deer, that'll take care of it. Well, that went nowhere and probably wouldn't have been successful anyway. And there's no, there's no medication, no inoculation, no anything yet that will help. So part of the problem remains getting people to remove obviously sick deer from the landscape during the hunting season, or at any time of the year they happen to see one, they can call and generally get permission to remove that animal and have it tested. That's one thing. Attempting to keep the herd down so that it's not so that the transmission rate or incidence is as reduced as it can be. Eliminating the feeding and baiting as is mandated by law when a positive CWD animal is detected in a county. you know, those are some of the basic things, but I don't think those alone are going to win the battle. And until there's some sort of a breakthrough that that will allow us to fight and win the battle, I'm discouraged by the CWD situation personally.
And it was discovered further out east, right? And or west rather, and they haven't been able to get a handle on it either, have they?
No, I mean, there's a national group that works on this, thinks about it, writes about it, informs the public about it, and there's been a tremendous and ongoing research effort to make some sort of a breakthrough here. But testing the animals has become difficult. I mean, we've gotten better at that, but there have been no major breakthroughs there. You know, what I, as a deer hunter, would like to see, and I don't have much faith that is going to happen, is something that, you know, a hunter can take in the field with them, and if they shoot an animal, think of it like a piece of litmus paper, and you pull this out of your wallet and dab it on the animal's tongue, and in 3 seconds it turns pink, red, blue, or something, and you know, oh, this animal's sick. That would be a great help and aid to hunters, but that kind of thing with this disease, the way it affects the animals, is probably not in the cards. So it's a tough battle, and it's an uphill battle, but it's still out there. And I guess I would just, for my part, in terms of educating the public about conservation issues, would just say, hey, don't forget about this.
Mm-hmm.
Do what you can. If you hear something new that may be helpful, then embrace it quickly. Otherwise, it becomes something that if the managers do feel they've all of a sudden got something that could help, you don't want to have two or 3 year time lag before people embrace it and implement it. So anyway, I guess that's my only take home message
mm-hmm.
right now. Don't forget about it, because it's not going away anytime soon.
And we appreciate you continuing to keep it top of mind for our listeners. One more thing: it's a while back, you know, we talked about the bull elk from the Black River State Forest that had wandered south looking for a mate, and he's not come to a really great end, has he?
No, good old bull number 357 wandered away from its herd near Black River Falls and ended up meeting its fate on I-55 southwest of Chicago. But in the process of getting from Black River Falls to southwest of Chicago, it became quite a celebrity, as it was picked up first on trail cameras up around Wausau and whatnot in Marathon County, and then later in Columbia County, and then it really hit the news when someone captured a cell phone video of it marching down the main road in McFarland outside of Madison on its way into Rock County and ultimately in Illinois, where it met its fate. It was a sad ending for this particular animal that was a young bull, probably out just looking for a mate and got headed in the wrong direction. But I think the take-home messages here for folks interested in this is that, number one, some of these animals, whether it's elk or mountain lions or bears or whatever, can travel across the landscape tremendous distances, avoiding problems like, for the most part, highways and development and people looking for them and assorted other things. So they can cover a lot of landscape. And the other issue I think that this brings some attention to is the notion of highway mortality.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many animals lose their lives on our roads. And that doesn't matter whether it's a mouse or a squirrel or a rabbit or a turtle or an elk wandering around looking for a mate. The carnage is incredible. And it's done by people presumably inadvertently, just going about their business. But it's a byproduct of us and our dedication and devotion to our cars and our interest in getting from point A to point B as quickly as we can. The problem being, a lot of animals die in the process. And it's very stressful for some folks. we were riding home from somewhere just before the holidays, and my wife hit a possum. You know, not an animal that a lot of people are particularly concerned about, but there was a bit of a thump, and this was a very stressful event. You know, did it get killed? And I said, well, it's not in the road. It apparently got off the road. You know, maybe it just got a thump out of it, and it's going to be fine. You know, that's one possible reaction is remorse over it happening. But despite the fact that we've got wildlife crossing, turtle crossing, deer crossing signs around, I don't see a great deal of effort to slow down when those signs are in place as you travel around. And again, much like CWD, that's kind of an out of sight, out of mind. The fact that all these animals are dying on our highways is a significant contribution to their mortality, and yet I think it's often dismissed as by they either don't know the animal was hit, or it's dismissed as, oh, that stupid rabbit, it shouldn't have run across the road at that time, or whatever. There's no sense of responsibility, nor any effort to really slow down or be more careful or aware or whatever. So yeah. I just pointed out as being a really a serious problem in wildlife conservation, and almost as difficult to deal with as chronic wasting disease.
Right. And we did talk to author Ben Goldfarb on, it was November 15th of last year now, about his book called Crossings. And it has to do with that same topic and promoting ways to get across highways and freeways for wildlife, you know, bridges or tunnels or what have you. So right. There's some people working on it, but not enough.
Well, it's an expensive proposition. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of solutions are usually reserved for areas with large populations of large mammals like elk or deer that typically migrate from one place to another. And if there's a way to safely get them across known highway barriers, then and that's a good thing, but the reality is everybody, virtually everybody drives, and so everybody plays a role in this. And, you know, be aware of certain times of the year when the turtles are moving around to find a nest site in June, or the deer are moving around in November during the rut to, you know, for breeding purposes. You know, be aware of when these tough times of the year are, where the things tend to happen, and at what time of day, and, you know, just be a little more cautious. You know, turn the radio down and keep your eyes open, kind of thing. But again, this is what befell poor old elk number 357. So he all of a sudden is the poster child for lots of dead animals on the side of the road.
Yeah, nobody likes to see that at all. We got time for one short question, Ed in Lodi. Oh, what do you got?
I just wonder, Scott, quickly comment on the impact of the coyotes and the bobcats on the deer population.
Okay, Scott, quick.
quickly. So there's a whole predator complex that includes bears, along with coyotes, fox, bobcats, and so forth, and they all kill and eat deer or scavenge on deer carcasses, some more than others. Bears are a major predator on deer fawns. And, of course, we know about the wolf situation. So, sure, this is part of the deal. These animals eat other animals, and deer are in the mix. But
all right. Well,
there
thanks.
You have it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Scott. We really appreciate you talking to us from down in Florida. Enjoy your time. Scott Craven has been with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ideas Network, and stay well.